thinking. Mm-hmm. So, hi. I'm going to talk a little bit about schools as well, a lot about schools, but a little bit about how we can try to make our research fit the context of schools a little bit better. So our current challenge is moving what we know about autism intervention from the research settings into the community, which I think people have laid out well. And I'd like to propose that we use some models and methodologies for mental health services research to help us do that with autism intervention. So a traditional translation process goes from basic science, translates then to us developing treatments and efficacy studies with very controlled populations and controlled settings based on that basic science. And then we need to translate one more time to go out into the schools or whatever setting we're going into with whatever providers we are working with. And you can see that unidirectional sort of way that we're used to doing things. And what the services research model proposes is that those arrows go both directions, and that we really look at those translation phases and the methodologies we use for that translation, not just the end products. And so I'd like to talk a little bit today about this phase two translation of moving an evidence-based practice into the community. So there are lots of definitions of evidence-based practice, and I like the one from the APA that evidence-based practice is the integration of the best available research with clinical expertise with the context of patient characteristics, culture, and preferences. And I think as researchers, we often just read the first line and we forget about the second half. And so today, I'd like to kind of give an example of why that second half can be important. So we know that having research-based practice or evidence-based practice is necessary for good care, but it's not sufficient, and we need to do more. That it currently takes 17 years for a practice to move from research into the community, too long. And then the effectiveness often isn't very good. There are a lot of studies from children's mental health literature showing that evidence-based practices implemented in the community aren't making the same results for kids. So, like Jill said, we want to think about practice-based evidence or the integration of what's happening in the field with what we know from science and a back-and-forth method of doing that rather than this unidirectional dissemination. So we want to identify what's working in the community, what's not working in the community, so we can increase what's working and decrease what isn't. And then look at what those barriers are, as Jill did in her schools, what the treatment providers value, what they like to do, and what they already know and what we can learn from them. And look at the overlap between what they're doing and what we know works and try to increase that. So those issues kind of come up in mental health services research for children with behavior disorders. I think we have those same issues in autism. For a long time, researchers have been saying when people implement our practices in the community, they are not using it with fidelity, they're not doing it the same level, they're using eclectic models. And educators and other clinicians are saying, yeah, but when you study kids, they are not as complex as the kids we're seeing, and our contexts are very different and under-resourced. We are adapting your programs because we need to. We also have the additional challenge of having a very complex multidisciplinary service system where kids with autism who are very heterogeneous are seen across multiple service systems. So it's not just moving into one clinician's office, it's moving in a lot of places. So we like to think of it ahead of time rather than being stuck somewhere with an intervention that won't work. There are challenges in collaborating. We have a lot of cultural differences between research and practice. One of the biggest is time. I'm a clinician, I see a practice, I want to learn it and try it. I'm a researcher, I want to take the manual away from you so you can't read it for 2 years until my grant is funded. And that's a big difference. Providers, like I said, can also see some of the research as irrelevant. We do a randomized clinical trial, and we think that's the gold standard, and we're so awesome, and we know that, you know, this one treatment A is better than treatment B, you know, for most of the kids, because there was a significant difference. But if I'm a teacher, I want to know what's going to work for Joey, because he's sitting right in front of me with his IEP goals, and that randomized trial doesn't help me. Providers also have a lot of competing demands. It is not their job to learn an intervention to fidelity necessarily. It's their job to make sure, you know, all their kids aren't running in the street or under a car on the playground, apparently. So there are a lot of other things they need to be doing. So we need to take all those things into consideration. So I want to talk a little bit about how we get that practice-based evidence, and Jill showed a nice example, but one of the ways we did it was to ask teachers, but to ask them nicely. We wanted to involve teachers, and literature shows it's important to involve providers early and often. So oftentimes we go and ask them things, but we already kind of know the answer, we've already designed the study or the intervention, and we need to involve them all along the way, and then generate knowledge together. So being respectful rather than condescending, and really believing we can learn and listen. We're used to teaching and training, and this process takes a lot of listening and learning. And then ongoing regular communication. So I think we heard that on other projects and talks this week, is really providing the participants and the stakeholders information about how what they're giving us is helping in terms of the research. So I'm going to provide an example of one way we've sort of used this method of gathering information to adapt a practice in a project looking at adapting pivotal response training for schools. Some of my co-investigators are here. This was supported by the U.S. Department of Education, and we had a research team as well as a team of community advisors. So briefly, there have been a lot of talks on pivotal response training, so I really want to focus on the process, but to get us all on the same page, it's an evidence-based practice that has been in existence for over 20 years. It's based, it's a naturalistic behavioral intervention based on the principles of applied behavior analysis, and the basis is motivating children with autism to learn across a variety of skills, but it was developed as a parent education model in one-on-one settings. So the manuals are based on that premise, and much of the research is based on that premise. It hasn't been used in schools. But when we surveyed teachers, I know that when you think of under-resourced settings, San Diego is the first place you think of. I'm going to talk about teachers in San Diego today. We are our education system, our state, is number 43 out of 50 in how much we spend per student. So relatively, compared to other states, our education system is under-resourced. A couple years ago, every teacher in our entire school district got a pink slip just in case they would be fired for the fall. It was a difficult year to recruit. But when we surveyed teachers in our area, 70% of them said they were using this particular method, but they were adapting it. But we didn't really know how they were adapting it, but we thought it was a good one to work on because we knew it had an evidence base and we knew that teachers were using it. So we have this grant and we took a four-phase approach. The first phase was to gather information from teachers, then to take the feedback they provided and test possible changes that they recommended to see what they did to the efficacy of this intervention, develop a manualized program specific to their needs, and then pilot test the adapted model. And throughout this entire process, we worked with a community advisory board. Sometimes they would take materials or feedback back to their classrooms to get more information from other teachers all throughout the study. But today I'm really going to focus on these first two phases, the gathering information and the testing the changes. So first we talk to teachers. We ask them about the kinds of adaptations needed for translation. We talk to teachers who were trained in PRT and still using it. We talk to teachers who were trained in PRT and chose not to use it. And we talk to teachers who use similar strategies but weren't specifically trained. And we ask them about the benefits and barriers of the strategy. We ask about each particular component and how they might have adapted it, how they used it, what settings and goals this particular strategy was good for, and how they integrated it with other strategies. So again, the data isn't as important to me as the process, but what we did was use qualitative methods and iterative design to come up with their overall feedback, which was that this is a strategy that made sense to them, they thought it was effective with the kids in their program, but they had a very hard time using it in groups, which is a problem in a classroom full of groups of kids. And they also came up with some things we didn't ask about, was that there were a lot of resources that they really needed in order to make this intervention fit their context. They needed group examples, they needed data sheets, they needed materials for training paraprofessionals who do a lot of the intervention. So that was really good information for us to find out. They also, I want you to note, gave us some feedback on specific steps that were hard, and that's going to become important after we look at what we found in the observation. Okay, so we also did some classroom observations of teachers using PRT, sort of under the best of circumstances. We had 19 special education teachers who were research trained as part of a dissertation by Dr. Jessica Sir-Heinrich, who trained these teachers, I think this actually was her master's project, sorry, trained these teachers to use PRT in their classrooms. This was the only strategy they were trained in. That was their kind of sole purpose of this project. And then 22 special education teachers who were in a larger trial learning PRT as part of a larger class-wide program where they had to learn several different strategies. So they had a little bit more of a challenge because they were learning this with other strategies. And then we assessed fidelity of implementation in the classrooms. And then we looked at use of each component of PRT. You see the percentage of teachers along the x-axis. That'll be the percentage of teachers meeting our 80% fidelity cutoff. And along the bottom, each of the different components of PRT. And so you see the research-trained teachers did a lot of the steps really well, a majority of them, and a couple of the steps not many were using. And when we look at the clinically trained sample, they did not meet fidelity, not as many of them met fidelity as often. Again, and David will talk a little bit about this project, but if we look at the data overall, we've followed these teachers for several years, the method of training for this particular sample and how it was fit in to the context of the other training, which I won't talk about today, but training context, extremely important, is why these numbers look like this. But I want you to notice the similarities for this particular talk right now of the things that were difficult or that not many teachers used, neither group used. And this particular step, this step called multiple cues, no teacher met fidelity on, and really, in fact, few teachers used it. And in the focus groups, the teacher said that this was a very difficult step to fit into the context of their classroom. So since we had sort of convergence in the observation and the focus groups, and this step was really the one that was most difficult, I want to use that as an example. We had other issues, but this is one I want to use today. So this multiple cues component, just briefly, because it is the most complex. Children with autism have difficulty attending to relevant cues in the environment. We know that, and we know that they sometimes pick out irrelevant cues, which can be a problem in learning. And so when PRT was developed, as part of it, we try to orient kids to relevant cues so that they can learn to do that and generalize it. And one of the ways in PRT that we do that, the main way, is through conditional discrimination. And so an example of a conditional discrimination is if I want a child to look at more than one aspect of an object. So we're coloring, and I've got a set of crayons in particular colors, and I've also got a set of colored pencils in the same colors. If I'm a child that wants to color, I not only have to ask for a particular color, but I have to ask for which type of implement. So I want a red crayon, or I want a blue pencil, rather than just one aspect. And that's one of the main components of PRT. So what the focus group teacher said was this is not good for us. We don't think it's developmentally appropriate for all the kids in our classroom. Some of them it's too difficult for. We have a really hard time doing this in groups, and we have a lot of kids to attend to, and setting up these types of really specified components is difficult. So we got this information, this practice-based evidence from the community, and it's good, but we don't want to just say, okay, so we'll throw that step out until we do some looking at it. So we went back into the laboratory and did some testing on multiple cues and how it was needed. The first thing we did was a literature review and found that most of the research on how kids respond to these simple discriminations was about 30 years old and done with populations of much older children with autism, of course, who are much more impaired. And although there was some literature to show that there was a relationship between developmental level and chronological age and how well kids could do this, very few, even typical kids below 5, were tested, so we really didn't know when typically developing kids started doing this. So as part of her dissertation project, Sarah Reed did a series of studies, the first looking at 31 typically developing children This is a simple discrimination task with colored blocks, which I'd be happy to explain with to you later if you're interested in it. They were 19 to 51 months, and what we found that was under 36 months of age, typically developing children are not able to do this conditional discrimination in most cases, but after 36 months, they are very, very consistently able to do it. So we felt confident with 36 months as a good time mental age for kids to be able to do this. So then we worked with 42 students with autism who were chronologically and mentally over 36 months of age. And what we found was that they also were really, in most cases, all but a couple of kids were able to do these conditional discriminations pretty well. And so we learned that the teachers were right. This is not a component of PRT that we need to do in exactly this way. We think what's happening, and we are working on next step would be to test it, is that because part of PRT is also using multiple examples and kids are getting intervention earlier and there's this nice focus on generalization now that there didn't used to be, that they're getting this ability to broaden their attention without having to do the specific conditional discrimination task. So that's how we have then used these recommendations from the teachers along with our experimental studies to make adaptations to the protocol that we think the teachers, and we know now the teachers, really are quite like and feel quite excited that their feedback made this change. So we developed some resources based on the feedback and our findings. Not all of the recommendations came back to studies that worked out quite so nicely in the teacher's favor, and in those cases we worked on developing resources that would help them integrate the strategies into groups. We worked with our advisory board and came up with this classroom pivotal response teaching manual. They helped name it. They really wanted a special name for their thing they helped develop, and the adaptations were based on the feedback and the studies. We found it important that we had professional materials to present to teachers and school districts that were already prepared, that they could take off the shelf and use in their classroom, rather than trying to adapt something read from a journal article or from our research materials. We provided group examples as well as a bunch of other resources that they asked for. We had them tested. Our advisory board took it in their classroom. They actually wrote most of the examples for us, because when we tried, they were laughing at us. And so it was a nice joint effort. And so what did we learn from doing this sort of iterative process? I think the most important thing we learned is that practice-based evidence really can inform science. This is a place where we learned a lot from just asking and watching what teachers were doing and made a really appropriate critical change to an intervention. And that we can test it. It just doesn't have to be like we trust you or you trust us. We're really testing it. We also learned that our partnerships have really paid off, both for this project and for future projects. We found teachers who really had an interest in implementing evidence-based practice, so they feel like they're learning a great deal from us, but they're also champions for us when we go out to do larger trials, when we go to try to engage school districts in lower resource areas who might not be as involved in research. They've been really kind and helpful and bought in. We also learned that sometimes teachers do judge a book by its cover, and that it is really important to have materials that look professional. They go to workshops with professional materials, and those are the things that kind of get them excited, because there's materials they can use right away. And as researchers, that is not our focus. We often have materials that work well for our graduate students, but not as well in the field, and it's important. Glossy paper is good. We also learned that teachers really like to be heard, and so we learned to listen. When we did our pilot study and our training, our trainers really went in with the idea that we understand your situation. We had former teachers doing training, and I'm almost done, and that we were really humbly bringing them a model that we hoped would help fit into their classroom, and they could help us make it fit. They also really liked having feedback about their own students. So bringing that feedback in terms of what changes we saw and they're seeing in their own students because of the use of this model really helped them buy in and keep going, and we think help with sustainability. And so that feedback piece is very important. So thank you very much. Anybody have a question?
I just have a quick question. Who publishes that CPRT?
Guilford.
Hi, I have a quick question as well. You showed the iterative process working really well. Did you have any experience of where you went back to the literature and you just thought, we can't really compromise what the situation is, and how do you square that circle when you go back to the teachers?
Yes, so we have had direct reinforcement is also a component of CPRT or of PRT, and the teachers have a hard time with that in the classroom where the reinforcement needs to be directly related to the task, and in a group that can be difficult. And so, but we know that already there are studies that show it's very important. So we've done a couple things. One is to provide a lot of examples of how to do that in a group and to provide more education on why it's imperative, so why is this step even important, and that helps them buy in, and then lots of examples. We're also trying to look at some innovative methods of using it and how kind of far from direct reinforcement we can get and still get the generalization, and so really the education piece and the helping with the integration is how we've worked on that, because they don't all turn out just the way you want.